Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank the organisers of the conference for inviting me to participate. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. I'm going to talk about the Iranian experience in the early 20th century. This paper looks at the foundation of the first modern gendarmerie in Iran by the newly established constitutional government in 1910, and the factors which led this new force to become a quasi-army, nurturing an educated, politically conscious, and nationalist officer corps ready to propose itself as a focus for national leadership in the post-World War I world. Although originally envisaged with modest functions as a rural police force, the gendarmerie quickly came to embody Iranian aspirations for territorial sovereignty and independence, a symbol of the new constitutional government's determination to resist further encroachments by the imperial powers of Britain and Russia. In order to reinforce this symbolic role, the Iranian government chose Sweden as a source of officer instructors for the new gendarmerie, believing Sweden to be both experienced in assisting with military and police organization and, unlike the major European powers, politically disinterested. The paper analyzes the way in which the gendarmerie stepped into the role of a national army in Iran, the previous century's efforts at state building having failed to produce such a force. It charts the gendarmerie's expansion in the years leading up to World War I, paying special emphasis to its burgeoning conflict with the other significant paramilitary force in the country, the Russian-officered Iranian Cossack Brigade. This conflict to culminate in the two forces siding with opposing blocs during the First World War, the gendarmerie with the Central Powers, the Cossack Brigade with the Entente. It follows the political maturing of the gendarmerie's officer corps, its increasing salience in national political life, its outstanding personalities, and its role in the political turmoil of the years after World War I and before the Cossack Brigade's coup d'état of 1921, which brought Reza Khan, later the first Pahlavi Shah, to power. The paper will conclude with a discussion of the role played by the gendarmerie in the emerging Pahlavi order in Iran. The government gendarmerie was established in 1910 by a new constitutional government, which had replaced the autocracy of the Iranian Shah, and may be seen as the most sustained in a series of Iranian projects for the modernization of the armed forces under the leadership of foreign officers. Throughout the 19th century, military modernization had been a constant preoccupation of Iranian reformers, and the history of the 19th century is peppered with attempts to create a standing army on the European model with the help of foreign officers. By the end of the 19th century, however, all had ended in failure, the only semi-modern military force in existence being the Cossack Brigade, a mounted paramilitary police force officered by Russians, modelled on Russian Cossack units, and held in profound and abiding suspicion by Iranian reformers. Iran entered the 20th century with a financially bankrupt and disintegrating central authority. For many of the participants in the Constitutional Revolution, which broke out in 1905, an important goal was the reform of government and the creation of a strong state capable of overcoming Iran's backwardness. Military modernization was a central plank of this general program. As well as growing domestic awareness of the necessity for the formation of a force capable of maintaining internal security, the Iranian government was, at this time, coming under pressure from another source. As provincial disorder had increased during the years after the Constitutional Revolution, the British government had demanded, ever more insistently, that some kind of force be set up which could guarantee security for trade, particularly in the south of the country. In 1910, therefore, prompted by both domestic and foreign pressure, the government took steps towards the organization of a national gendarmerie. This was embedded in a general program of reform, the National Assembly voting for a project whereby Iran would apply, first of all, to Italy for gendarmerie instructors, to the United States for financial experts, and to France for assistance to the ministries of the Interior and of Justice. The Iranian government first applied to Italy for the loan of gendarmerie instructors, but Russia and Britain opposed this choice, Italy ranking among the major powers. Iran then decided to approach a minor power and quickly reached an agreement with the Swedish government, which agreed to provide a mission to instruct and officer a gendarmerie, to be formed under the Iranian Ministry of the Interior, its primary duty to be the maintenance of security on Iran's roads. The Swedish motives are interesting. In the late 19th century, Sweden's foreign policy had turned away from France towards Germany and kept a suspicious eye on Russia, which they considered the country's only real strategic threat. While upholding their neutrality, the Swedes sought to enhance deterrence against their eastern neighbour by reforming their own army. Within this framework, Swedish officers often trained abroad, especially in Germany, and assumed missions in the Belgian Congo and in Ottoman Macedonia, where they reformed the gendarmerie. Stockholm accepted Tehran's 1910 request to send a mission because, besides hoping to advance its commercial interests, Iran offered a field for experiments and exercises, and thus, strategically, an opportunity to enhance its deterrence against the Russians. The Swedish military mission, led by Major, eventually General, H.O. Hjalmarsson, with two other officers, arrived in Tehran in August 1911. Seven more Swedish officers arrived before the end of the year. They immediately began to carry out their initial task, establishing and training a paramilitary police force for use in the rural areas and especially to protect trade routes. Over the next 2 years, the force made steady progress, gradually consolidating its position and extending its influence over an ever-widening radius from Tehran. Numerical and organizational growth was consistent. At the end of 1912, the government gendarmerie numbered 21 Swedes and nearly 3,000 Iranian officers and men. By the end of the following year, the number of Swedish officers had risen to 36, and the Iranian component had doubled to nearly 6,000. The gendarmerie's budget requirements grew accordingly and were met in this period largely out of loans from Britain and Russia. In the absence of a national army, the gendarmerie was quickly becoming a focus of Iranian nationalist objectives, but it encountered opposition from a number of domestic sources. The very nationalist opinion which supported military modernization in general began to be concerned about the support, both political and financial, which the gendarmerie received from Britain, and considered the extension of its control to be synonymous with a growth in British influence. Tribal opposition to the gendarmerie was another problem. The disintegration of central authority during the constitutional period had led to a general reassertion of tribal power and activity, and the appearance of the gendarmes, representing the reassertion of central control on the roads in the south and elsewhere in the country, was widely and accurately perceived by the tribal leaderships, the Khans and Aghas, as a threat to their own position. Russian suspicion was another problem. The construction of the gendarmerie had originally been undertaken partly in response to British pressure, and in these years, the force was always assured of British support. Initially, too, the Russian authorities were content to acquiesce in British wishes in this matter. However, the very success of the gendarmerie, particularly in the north of the country, gradually provoked a new difficulty in the form of growing Russian hostility. The Russian government began to develop plans to use only the Cossack Brigade in the Russian sphere of influence in northern Iran, while the gendarmerie would be reserved for the British zone in the south. A plan which heightened a danger which was ever present in the minds of Iranians, that Iran would be partitioned between the imperial powers. Perhaps the most important feature domestically of the gendarmerie in this period lay in the human resources which it mobilized, specifically the progress which it made in assembling and consolidating an Iranian officer corps. The Iranian gendarme officers were of relatively high social standing and well-educated. Some had, on their own initiative, acquired education and military training abroad, the military college in Istanbul being the most popular destination, although a few also went to Saint-Cyr in France or to institutions in Austria and Germany. Many spoke a foreign language, usually French. The government gendarmerie made a highly significant contribution to the advancement of nationalist activity in Iran during the First World War. Its experiences during these years transformed the force. By their participation in the armed nationalist struggle against Russia and Britain, the gendarme officers were propelled to a position of national leadership, spearheading the struggle against foreign intervention. And from 1917, the force was able to claim a central role in the various strategies put forward to reverse Iran's accelerating political chaos and disintegration. In 1914, although Iran declared its neutrality, the war had a profound impact on the organizational and political development of the force. The Swedish government decided that all its officers in Iran who were still on the active list of the Swedish army must return home. This produced a serious weakening in the Swedish command structure of the force, but allowed the senior Iranian officers to assume greater responsibility and authority. The most significant effect of the war may be found in the growing politicization of the officer corps of the force. During the early months of the war, the gendarmerie decisively shook off its association with Britain, and as a result of the new international situation, became drawn with its civilian nationalist partners into an alliance with Germany. Iranian nationalism had been trying for some time to enlist the intervention of a third power in Iranian affairs, as a means of counterbalancing Britain and Russia. America had been tried without success, but now the war presented the possibility that Germany might play that role. Iranian nationalists became interested in a German victory, insofar as it would hurt Britain and Russia and promote the cause of Iran's independence, and Germany encouraged them in this hope. Nationalist sympathies, then, and a tactical alliance with Germany explain the orientation of the nationalist gendarmes. For the Swedish officers, however, who shared this orientation, it seems that genuine admiration and respect for Germany was an important factor in determining their allegiance, and the most cordial relations had existed between the Swedes and the Germans in Iran since the Swedes' arrival. The majority of the Swedish officers had undergone courses or attended maneuvers in Germany, were all imbued with the highest admiration for the German army and the German military system generally, and were in fact incapable of conceiving that Germany might be defeated in the war. As 1915 progressed, the struggle between the Allies and the Central Powers for control of the Iranian government and the capital, Tehran, intensified. In late 1915, in order to preempt a pro-German coup, Russian troops began to advance on Tehran from the north, prompting the departure from the capital of government officials, nationalists and their armed supporters, and many of the officers and men of the gendarmerie, and members of the German, Ottoman and Austrian missions. Fleeing to western Iran beyond the reach of the Russian armies, the nationalists established a provisional government, with the gendarmes as the core of their organized support. They were now in armed opposition to the government still installed in Tehran under Allied control and protection. Gendarme officers and civilian nationalists also seized control of a number of towns across various parts of western and southern Iran. As the Russian armies advanced westwards, the gendarmes fought a number of engagements with them, but eventually they and their nationalist supporters were forced into exile in Ottoman territory. Many of the Iranian officers went into exile, A few to Germany, but the majority to Istanbul, where some entered the Ottoman army. Some gendarme officers with their men, however, immediately began to filter back into Iran. Initially dispersing to their homes, they soon found their way back into a newly reorganized Iranian government gendarmerie. Notwithstanding the turmoil of 1915 to 16, Iranian governments had remained committed to a principle of a gendarmerie. They still possessed, in the few remaining Swedish officers and the Iranian officers, the core around which the force could be rebuilt. Their proposals for reconstructing the gendarmerie were incorporated into wider schemes, reminiscent of pre-war plans for raising and financing a national army. By 1917, a newly reorganized gendarmerie, its prestige with nationalist opinion high as a result of its actions during the war, was expanding rapidly. The collapse of Tsarism in 1917 meant that Russian hostility no longer impeded the development of the force, and regiments were formed throughout northern Iran. By early 1920, a sophisticated structure had been established. The strength of the gendarmerie was now three Swedish officers, including the commandant, 242 Iranian officers, and over 8,000 men. The estimates provided for continued expansion, and by the time of the coup in February 1921, the force numbered nearly 10,000. The officers' school provided a high standard of training for officers, many of whom were to reach high rank in the new army of the 1920s. In the years 1918 to 21, the symbiotic relationship between the gendarmes and the nationalist movement continued. Many of the officers and men sympathized with various of the radical movements which appeared in the area in the aftermath of the Great War, including Kemalism and even in some cases to Bolshevism. It also led to their involvement in the planning and execution of the coup d'etat of February 1921. Since the collapse of Tsarism in 1917, the gendarmerie's nationalism had been directed solely against Britain, the remaining imperial power in Iran. Nonetheless, because of their individual military expertise and because of the prestige of their corps, gendarme officers were closely involved in the work of the Anglo-Persian Military Commission, which was set up under the terms of the Anglo-Persian Agreement of 1919 and was to devise proposals for building a new Iranian army led by British officers. Many of the gendarme officers were unhappy with the work of the commission and the nature of British proposals, feeling that they damaged Iranian independence and integrity. In fact, in one case, shortly before the commission produced its report in April 1920, one of its gendarme members committed suicide, an act that was widely interpreted as a protest against the agreement and what they feared to be the military subjection of Iran. The gendarmerie now constituted a factor of considerable political importance in Iran, and certain circles within the force were drawn into the coup preparations being made in late 1920, led by the Cossack colonel Reza Khan. Although in the light of their past relationship and differing international and internal political orientation, it may seem surprising that the gendarmes and Cossacks were able to agree on joint action, in fact, their traditional hostility had been modified and even partially superseded by recognition of common interest. It was their common opposition to British control, implied in the proposals of the Anglo-Persian Military Commission, which first forged political links. This sympathy between the two forces was the first step on the road which led to the successful collaboration in the execution of the coup. In fact, there is some evidence which suggests that elements within the gendarmerie may have been planning a coup of their own, which was only just preempted by the Cossack march on Tehran. In February 1921, Reza Khan, at the head of a Cossack column, took over Tehran. The gendarmerie was rewarded with important posts in the new government and also with considerable power in the provinces. In the months immediately following the coup, the gendarmerie attained the height of its political power and organizational development. But by the end of 1921, it was submerged in Reza Khan's Cossack division. Reza Khan, now Minister of War, ensured both in the new army and the regime constructed around it his own supremacy and the ascendancy of his comrades from the Cossack division. owing to their resentment at the way in which they were incorporated into the new army and their dislike of the character of the new regime, the ex-gendarmes constituted a nucleus of political opposition for much of the 1920s. However, although Reza Khan distrusted the ex-gendarmes, in constructing his new army, he was obliged to utilise in full the human resource comprised by their military expertise and experience. The accumulation of a cadre of officers and non-commissioned officers of high quality was perhaps the single most significant feature of the gendarmerie's existence and was a legacy of enormous value. Much of Reza Khan's success in the 1920s may be seen to have been predicated upon the earlier achievements of the gendarmerie.
Thank you. I just have one or two images. This is the Cossack Brigade with its Russian Cossack officers, and you can see quite clearly that their uniform is modelled on that of Russian Cossack units. This is the gendarmerie and the Swedish officer in front, and you can see that their uniform is quite different. These are two of the best known of the Iranian gendarmes of the pre-war, pre-coup period. The taller one, he's not wearing it in this image, but he was awarded the Iron Cross by Germany. He served in the German army at the end of the war. And this is the Swedish Military Museum in Stockholm, where they have a display of uniforms and paraphernalia to do with the Swedish mission. So if you go to Stockholm, you can take a look at it. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup pour...